right. Hello. We're going to start 5 minutes early because you're all here and the doors are closed. So why wait, right? I think we've got enough material here today. Thank you for coming to our panel. This is a great crowd. You have come to Brands with Benefits, Hooking Up with Good Deals. And I think we'll have a lively discussion about the digital deal space and how consumer behavior is changing in the retail environments. My name is Sarah Fay, and I'll be your moderator today. I'd like to ask about you. Can you raise your hand if you are a brand, if you're with a brand? All right. How about agencies? Good. And if you are with a media provider or technology? All right. I won't bother to ask about other. I have with me a group of digital leaders in this space. These guys are experts at intercepting that promiscuous customer as they go down the path to purchase, to keep them on task and on track, or perhaps to turn their heads at the last possible second with different choices. So I'm going to introduce them in just a minute, but first I'd like to get you to get your head around a few concepts and statistics about the deal space. So first, digital deals are a major trend that are creating a massive shift in the retail marketplace. A Booz Allen survey told us that 62% of deal seekers are now using digital sources for at least half of their shopping trips. So that's a big number, and that's a big shift in a short period of time. Also, we've crossed the halfway mark with smartphones. So smartphones now represent more than 50% of the mobile marketplace, and we also know that people using smartphones are spending more than an hour a day interacting with their phones, and shopping is one of the top three behaviors. And in fact, a 2011 Comscore study tells us that 50% of in-store purchase abandonment is due to finding a better price in another store. A better price in another store while you are standing in the store considering a product. So that is interesting behavior. And meanwhile, we have this mobile payments growing rapidly and money starting to flow through that. It's predicted by the Yankee Group. In 2015, $1 trillion will be flowing through mobile payments. So we are talking about a mega trend, massive shift. And retailers and brands are trying to figure all that out and try to get their arms all around this. How can they create loyalty with shoppers, make the shopping experience easier and better, full of those deals that shoppers love, and message to them when it's time to shop again? And that's what we're going to talk about. So let me introduce my esteemed panelists who are here today. On the end, we have John Caron. He is the CMO and heads up business development at Motive Media, which is helping consumers experience in-store shopping in a whole new way. And he'll tell us more about that. Next to him, we have Florent Pear, who is VP of Strategy and Business Development at Gilt City, which is the latest brand created under Gilt Group, that fabulous daily deals site for brands with cachet. Don't I know it? And finally, we have my good friend here on the end, Tom Burgess, well known to many in the room as a serial entrepreneur with a number of big successes under his belt in the emerging media space. And today he is CEO of Linkable, which is allowing digital deal seekers to link promotions and savings directly to the credit cards that they carry for shopping and realizing those deals when they actually make a purchase in store or on site. So three very different approaches to making consumers' lives better and at the same time giving brands and retailers a chance to bring them closer to purchase. So let's get going. I'll ask my first question, and I think it makes sense given our topic today to talk about loyalty because I think a lot of people think that deal behavior is not loyal, right? There are plenty of people who say brands like Groupon create a lot of one-time purchases. So Not necessarily always the case, and I know each of you will have a different take on this. I thought we would begin with John.
Sure. Thanks. Loyalty is a key component about engaging customers. And when it comes to deals, it's all about context. What context are you putting that deal to that shopper? We talk about Groupon, right? It's one offer for everybody. Everyone's treated the same. If you think about the in-store experience, when you all walk into a store, the stores have no context of who you are. So how do they create and offer you a deal that influences your behavior based on you as an individual? And this is where mobile comes in, bless you. You have the ability to engage shoppers through an app and leverage the loyalty data that you have on them, right, based on all their shopping behavior. And you have the ability to target them with offers based on who they are, what they like, how much they buy, where they physically are in the store, and what they've just scanned and or looked at. And when you take deals to that level, leveraging loyalty, it really will change behavior because you're influencing them right there in the aisle at the last point. They're going to make a decision before they make a purchase.
How about you, Florent? Guilt. Do you have evidence that people buying on guilt develop loyalty towards certain brands?
Right. So do you guys hear me well? I'm there in the back, yeah. So before actually I tackle the guilt aspect of things, I wanted to come back just for a second on what a loyalty program is trying to solve. The basic premise is to say that acquiring a new customer is going to always cost you more. It's going to be more complex than actually retaining an existing customer, right? So that's why you actually want to develop strategies that enables you to retain those existing customers. There's a second benefit to that, which is the fact that existing customers tend to provide data back to you, right? So if I'm acquiring a new guy on an ad network, I don't know what that cohort behavior is going to be. If I have somebody who actually purchased on guilt, let's say 6 months ago, I can see any type of data behind that from, what type of sales do they look at, what type of product they're more likely to buy, and all of those good stuff. So that was kind of like the quick step back. And then the additional thing I would add there is that loyalty programs tend to be a lot more effective when you have a customer base that is kind of an 80-20 rule. So think of a good example is MasterCard. When you talk to MasterCard, they're going to tell you that 5% of their 1.7 billion people is actually responsible for 50% of the transaction, right? So when you think about that, you're like, wow, I actually need to absolutely retain those 5% because that's going to be critical for my business. So bringing that back to guilt, what we've seen on our end is that any type of purchase we see every month is actually done, 87% of those purchases are done by an existing customer. So it's actually pretty critical for us to retain those guys. And we have a variety of strategy in place. We developed a loyalty program called Guilt Noir, which is really about the big spender and so on. We've done things around personalization and so on. But what we've seen is that we see a pretty big proportion of loyal customers. And then we also see that some of those customers are actually attached to some brands. And that's why we kind of released something where you can follow a brand on guilt. And then final point, that they're also kind of very open to discover a new brand as long as you're very smart about what type of brand you want to show to them. So.
Okay. And Tom, you deal with loyalty in terms of, the actual payment process, right? And it's not just loyalty to the retailers and the brands, but it's also the credit cards themselves. And, they worry about getting knocked out with the whole concept of mobile payments and things like that. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think probably first thing I got to ask a question. How many of you guys have a loyalty card like a CVS card or a Stop and Shop card? Hands up. Look, almost everybody put your hand up, right? So they're going away. They're gone. They're dead, right? They are worthless now. And it goes back to one of the things that Florent says in that he's got data on his users. He doesn't have data on the users as they shop in other places. The credit card companies, as Sarah mentions, have a great deal of data on the cross-purchasing, right? So what's happening is that the credit card companies, and I'm talking about the whole environment, right? It could be the banks who issue the cards. It can be the four card associations that we all know. It can be the processors, which is another set of companies. They've all got a ton of data on what we do, and they've never really monetized it on a person-by-person basis, right? They monetize it in a big group. So as Sarah mentioned, that the loyalty thing that the banks are looking for, they call it top of wallet, right? And they want you and I to pull their card out first when we walk in and we're going to make that purchase. So the banks have realized this, and they've started their own loyalty capability. And the stores now, in partnerships with the banks, will be able to see across all our purchases, and we'll be able to personalize, which we'll talk about a little bit, the offers and so forth we get. But and then we're going to go into a little more of that.
Cool. All right. So here, the consumers, I picture them, you know, they're busy, they're looking for deals, they're educating themselves about the products they want to buy. How does a brand insert themselves into that process? How do you avoid purchase abandonment if somebody is at the store shelves looking at your product? I'd like John maybe to take a whack at that one.
Sure, happy to. One of the things that we look at my company, which is called Motive Media, we do it's an all-in store, and we're very retailer-centric. So the idea is that when a shopper walks into a store, how many apps are they going to open? They will open at least one, right? So are you creating an environment where the shoppers are engaging your brands, or are they just coming in to facilitate a need? How are you engaging that shopper? And so as a brand, you've got two paths that you can go down. You can go down the path where you try to directly engage them, or another one where you circumvent, and that circumvents the retailer, or you partner with the retailer. I think one of the things that we're going to see over the course of the next year is the fact that as in-store technologies and in-store micro-location technologies advance, that you will have the ability to leverage loyalty data, location data, the shopper data, shopper behavior, and influence what they buy just before they're going to reach for a product. And I think that is extraordinary. A perfect example of it is, raise your hand if you've shopped on Amazon. Have you? All right, I'm assuming everybody's hand went up. When you go to Amazon, the experience is not generic. When you go there, it knows who you are, where you've been, how you got to the site, if you've bought anything, you look at products, it gives you recommendations, etc. But none of that occurs when you walk into the store. So how do you replicate that same environment that we're all comfortable with online, actually in the store? And mobile is the piece that will actually connect the physical store location with the shopper using their own device.
Actually, if I can, may I add something? So I tend to agree with John on any type of like undifferentiated product. So think of you selling shampoo. It's extremely tough for you to, you know, be competitive versus Amazon, right? You're in CVS, you know, you're buying that shampoo there, or you're buying it on Amazon. It doesn't really matter. When you're talking about product that have a lot bigger emotional link to your life. So, you know, one good example that we know at Gilt is fashion, right? So when you're talking about fashion, there's a bunch of tactics you can do at the store level to ensure that you still stay competitive versus the internet competitors, right? So one way to look at it is I've been pretty amazed by what J.Crew's done over the past, you know, 5-7 years. And, in New York, they opened a couple of stores that are extremely, I would say, almost editorialized, right? So they have like a men's store that is in Tribeca, that is in an old liquor store. And the image, the almost to the smell aspect of the store brings you back to kind of like a very comfortable environment where you actually want to buy, where there's a lot of like serendipity attached to it. Like you're falling on something interesting, you like the atmosphere, the sales associates are fantastic. So those type of things actually is probably something that the online retailer will never going to be able to replace, right? Because when you're shopping, even on Gilt, even though we're trying to do our best with beautiful creative and so on, you can get distracted at any point of time by, you know, somebody's talking to you while you're looking at your computer, or any, you know, your kid is asking you something and anything like that.
Yeah.
So that's something that that's probably a nice strategy to look at as well.
That's a great strategy for an in-store retailer. And really, I think that there's all kinds of things like that going on. I kind of feel sorry for the brands who are doing a really good job marketing, maybe spending $5 million on a campaign and getting people to walk into a store to want to buy something and then losing the sale to another brand potentially because of something that's happening in the store. I mean,
So, you know, it's a matter of purchase consideration. One of the things that when we launched Linkable, Sarah and I got talking. She said, oh, you're in the path of purchase consideration. And if you look at the slide, you'll see the whole concept here is that a consumer can now find an ad anywhere on any medium, be it a banner, be it on your mobile device. It could be on the side of a bus or on TV and a radio. And that consumer can now click on that or scan a QR code or dial a star code and link that offer right to the existing card that's in your pocket right now, right, across any medium. Now that consumer's got this offer sitting on their card. And this is in the path of consideration. So for the brand, they know, hey, look, we've engaged an audience. There's a branding aspect to that. But then they also have that closed loop. So now you're the consumer. You go into the store and you're like, oh, hey, wait a minute. I've got a discount already on that product. So it does help drive that consumer through. It also tells the brand a great deal about you specifically and your needs and desires are going to be personalized, but the brand now gets that closed loop attribution. So the brand says, hey, my ad worked. I got a whole bunch of people that linked this offer to their card and send some percentage actually converted and purchased. And we'll show a case study, I think, in a bit about how that data can be used.
Yeah. It's what we're talking about a lot here is called the showrooming effect. Has anybody heard of the showrooming effect? You know, I guess Best Buy is kind of the poster child of this. People call it the Amazon showroom because people go in and they check the products and the prices, and then they check and see if they can get a better price on Amazon. And if they can, sometimes they will make that purchase instead of purchasing in the store. I thought that the J.Crew example was a good example of like how you would combat that. But is there anything else, you know, that a retailer could do to keep from, you know, losing business to a, you know, just a lower cost provider? They have to lower their prices?
I think that's a huge thing. In fact, actually, that's what our company tries to help retailers do, which is the fact that if you're competing on price as a retailer, then you're going to lose, right? If all you're trying to do is sell the TV for a little bit less, then you're going to lose. Raise your hand if you've bought an iPhone or an iPad or any Apple product. Love to know. All right. So wait a minute. Hold on. Keep hands up. Now, leave your hand up if you bought that at the Apple store. Most of you did. Why? Why did you buy it at the Apple store? Because you could have got it at Best Buy. It's fabulous. Exactly. It's the experience, right? Best Buy will give you $50 if you buy an iPhone from them, right? They'll give you $50, literally. But why do we all go to the Apple store, right? Why do we go there? Because it's a different experience, right? And there are things that can happen in the physical store, whether it's just customer service or whether it's leveraging technology or it's certain innovation or, as Laurent mentioned, I think this J.Crew idea is actually just the tip of the iceberg. I think we're going to see a massive change in the way retailers build out their stores. But I think a big piece of that is going to be in how they leverage technology like mobile. You can deliver a much better level of service. You can get rid of the cash register. Why are their cashiers? It's a complete waste of freaking time. I hate it, right? If anyone shop at BJ's or Costco, why do we have to pick up all that crap, put it in a big barge, right? Wheel it up. Somebody who's paid not a lot of money picks it up, runs it across a barcode reader and puts it back. What is the intrinsic experiential value in that? Nothing.
Okay, is Costco in the room? How about Best Buy? Have we embedded you guys enough
who
yet?
Who else are we beating up? Yeah. Oops, yeah, should we asterisk that. But the point is, you know, technology, when engaged with the customer, can change the experience. And if the experience is changed, then price becomes less relevant, and we will change our buying behavior in the store.
All right, that's enough about loyalty for now. I'm feeling a little bit too much relationship pressure. Let's talk about branding. So the deal space and branding, do they go together? I don't know. You know, it doesn't feel, it feels counterintuitive. Are you doing harm to a brand by offering too many deals? And I think that Gilt actually has some pretty good examples of this, and I'm going to bring up some visuals. But Florent, I'd like to talk to you about how people are using the deal space to improve branding.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, if you think of like your basic, I don't know, KGB deal or I don't want to say Groupon because they actually, there's a lot of stuff they're doing that is good and well done. But in general, you're thinking of your brand, you don't see necessarily the brand lift if you're going to put that front and center 50% off on one of the deal side, right? And so one thing we try to do at Gilt City, you know, Jet Setter, is try to package it in a different way. And I think John mentioned at the beginning, you know, it's all about the context, right? And it is really that, right? So when we started talking with Virgin probably like a year ago, and we're trying to find a way to partner elegantly and with something interesting to do. So we started by doing a bunch of flight offers, but instead of doing just like the regular economy, we actually sold percentage off the more like the premium class on their plane, right? Worked super well, very interesting, a lot of millions of dollars, gigantic share of flights, so to speak, for them because they were selling 10 packs. So if you think about it, I'm a Delta customer and now I'm buying 10 flights on Virgin, then I'm locked for the next year, right? So that's a very elegant way to actually lock a customer or acquire a customer from somebody else. And then came fall and, you know, Cyber Monday and Black Friday and the gigantic noise you have around that. And we try to come up with something interesting. So we said, why not sell a full plane, right? So you and if you have 145 friends, which is, you know, it seems like it's a tough one to pull off, but actually I'll tell you that it's actually not that bad. And so if you have 145 friends and yourself, and you have also a credit card where you can actually put $60,000 on it, which is not my case for sure, then, you know, buy a plane on Gilt City with Virgin America. And so the idea there, and it actually comes down to not a, it's not a very expensive one, right? It's any trip in the U.S., return trip, it comes down to $400, and that comes with unlimited food and, more importantly, unlimited alcohol.
And Florence taking us all. We have a jet outside.
Exactly. It's about 100. I bought the plane. It's right there. You guys are all welcome. Yeah. Although it's 400 people here. But, hold on. And so what we did is we did a lot of pre-marketing for that opportunity. And then when that went public, the offer, then we really saw a lot of nice earned media impressions. And so when you look at it from a brand perspective, right, you're like, the cost here is actually fairly small. You're garnering about 80 million impressions of free media on PR and social media and so on. It's actually brand lifting for both Virgin and Gilt City because it feels like a very innovative idea and something that hasn't been done before. And then we sold the plane in less than 4 hours, and then we had more than 1,000 people who said, you know what, actually, I want to waitlist myself because I would love to buy that plane. And so that's you know, for Virgin, they were extremely happy because that's $60 million of potential revenue right here. And it's a lot of people that that actually said that they were interested in that. And the funny story behind it, that it was actually bought by Stanford Business Class alumni because they do once a year a big trip to Miami where they get hungover and, you know, hammered on alcohol, just like we do here, all here, and then come back. So it was really a good brand lifting exercise. I'll go super fast on the next one because I'm being slow here. But what we've done with Range Rover with another play here, which was, and I want to talk about that example a little bit because it's a full price. That's a good example of not being blocked to do only discount on deal site. And actually, we don't define ourselves at deal site, but that's another story. So Range Rover was launching a few, I would say, weeks ago. a new SUV, and it's been a while since they haven't launched anything. There was a big deal for them, and they wanted to do it in a very innovative way. And so what we've done is we've defined, we've actually launched a, we kind of like took over Gilt and Jet Setter and City and put all of that together and did a big launch event for them, right? So we sold the first car ever was on Gilt, and it was, you know, it's actually a $60,000. We only do stuff around $60,000, by the way. So, and the way it works is that you put a benefit, you put down a 5K deposit. That, by the way, gets you the right to buy that car, and then on top of that, you get $5,000 of credit you can spend on Gilt, right? So it's a fun one for the agency and the brand. It was actually a very smart one. We got a lot of press media attention on this one as well, and it was good to tie up the travel space with a local space, which was really Gilt City, with just a national platform such as Gilt. So those are the two examples that I have in mind about a good way to actually do something with a brand and a deal side that doesn't feel like it's discounted.
I think those are really interesting examples of, you know, brands that you wouldn't normally associate with the deal space. It speaks a lot to the desirability of those brands, too. Probably wouldn't work necessarily for, you know, all types of brands, but it absolutely is not. I think it's something that's unexpected. So I'd also like to talk about social media, because I think social media is really playing into the deal space too, and brands are just starting to get their arms around the basics, but how effective are they actually being? I think, John, you can speak to this.
Yeah, well, I believe Facebook's a fad until they hit 1 billion people. It doesn't really matter. It's technically irrelevant. 700 minutes a month? Yeah, 700 minutes a month, right? Social is extraordinary. We all talk about social. The question is, as a brand or retailer, how do you monetize that, right? How do you track it? How do you leverage it? How do you engage it, right? How do you create an environment where you're leveraging deals in a way that you can control them? Our company actually is going to be doing a test with Procter & Gamble and a grocery retailer called Ahold, which owns Stop & Shop and Giants, for those of you on the East Coast. And the idea is that you will be able to share a coupon from their mobile app right on Facebook. Now, first blush, you're probably all thinking yourself, BFD, we can already do that. I can post something on Facebook. By the way, I don't know if anybody has grabbed coupons off of Facebook from Procter & Gamble, for example, but I learned recently that if you go to their Facebook page and like their page, they'll give you a $2 coupon. Anybody know how you get it? Guess. What's the dumbest way to send it? There you go. They mail it. Shocking, huh? I mean, for God's sakes, Tom's company, they could just literally load it to your credit card in a millisecond, right? In our company, they could load it to the app. So brands and retailers are testing social, but they don't fully understand it. One of the things we're looking at is the idea of what if you can share a coupon, right? So I get a coupon and I share it up on Facebook, and my friends can grab it. Now, they can actually load it directly to their mobile app, and they can use it in store. They can share it as well, and their friends can grab it. Well, a couple things to think about. If you're a brand, and I saw a lot of brand hands here, let's say you put a killer coupon up there, a $5 off coupon up there, and you say, go ahead and share it. Next thing you know, 10 million people have grabbed it, and you've lost your job. So that's a problem, right? So how do you control it in a way? How do you set caps? So we've thought about how do you cap the coupon. But most importantly, how do you identify the socially influential shoppers that you've got? How do you track it so that when A shares it with B and B shares it with C, by the time they get to F, you can track that all the way back to A and identify who is really socially influential. So social isn't, you know, it's a very, very powerful tool in both ways, right? It can get completely, completely out of control if you don't manage it, right? And there's some aspect, and I'm not talking about trying to manage what people talk about on your Facebook page. Get over it. People like you, people hate you. That's just how it goes. But what's nice, as we've seen on social, is that the people who like your brands will protect your brand. Let them do it. They're very good at it. But when you're talking about deals, right, the fact that you want to put a deal out there and leverage social, not just to get the deal everywhere, But to get to leverage the real power of social networking, which is the ability for friends to influence friends' buying behavior, and we all know that's one of the greatest sources of influence.
Excellent. And Florent, I know.
Yeah, actually, you were talking about that that aspect of, you know, sometimes it goes viral and it's a bad thing. So I don't think we share that super publicly, but I'll share it because it's a fun story. So we did a partnership with United. It was not a gigantic, innovative one. It was a nice one, like kind of like bread and butter. You know, you get miles on United if you spend on guilt, right? And so it was, you know, on paper, it was fantastic. We launched it great. And then we're like, oh, my God, it's fantastic. It's taking off. Everybody's using it. And then we started looking at that cohort of new people we acquired. And at the same time, on guilt taste, we had something that was we were selling daikon for, I think, $1.50, right? And because we forgot to actually set up a minimum purchase amount, we had those thousands of people flocking to our site, getting those miles for their United membership, and then buying daikon. And then they were gone. So it's a good example of like actually making sure that you set up everything well before you go on your promotion, because then it just doesn't work well. Anyway, so just wanted to actually talk a little bit about something that has been announced not so long ago, and I thought it was actually an interesting one. How many of you guys are familiar with the Amex deal with Foursquare? And so the Twitter one is actually it's pretty much based off the same ID and the same platform at Amex, which is their smart offer engine. But it's taking, I feel, a little step further. So basically, let me very quickly explain it to you guys. And so the way it works is that if you have an Amex and if you are spending at certain spaces, then you're going to get a discount. And the way it works is you link your Twitter account with your American Express account. And so you pretty simple one or two step process. Once you've done that, you go on Twitter, and if you actually send a tweet with a specific hashtag, in that case, it's Whole Food. I think it's Whole Food Amex hashtag. Then you get how much is that? $10,
$15. $25 off if you buy $75.
Well, thank you very much.
Are you with Amex?
So I'm happy.
Oh,
great.
You're
come
no
on
actually.
Up and explain it.
No, so yeah, tell me if I do a bad job at explaining that, by the way, because now I better be careful. So I thought it was actually a very, very good one, and I thought it was actually good on a couple of levels, but one of them is the fact that for the three parties, both for Amex, Twitter, and the merchant, it actually makes a lot of sense, right? For Twitter, it just feels a good way for them to kind of link a tweet to a transaction, something they've never done before, right? And something that I felt was key for them in the future to actually prove the effectiveness of the platform and say that people that are on Twitter, the people who are actually sharing those billions of tweets, are actually also deep in the purchase funnel, and you can convert them into customers. So for Twitter, I thought it was actually a big one. For Amex, I love the fact that it's a lot of earned media, and it's also a lot of, you're going to start following Amex to try to hear about those promotions, right? So then they're building their online presence and social media presence, and then on the back end of that, they're just pushing a lot more innovative models to say, hey, maybe you should get rid of your plastic card. There's a bunch of where you can still spend with Amex without necessarily using your plastic card. And then for the merchant, I thought it was actually good as well, because it's new customers and it's a loyalty. I actually don't know exactly the term of the deal, so maybe you're going to help us on that. But my take on it was that Whole Foods was not paying a lot of money out of that. I don't know if that's going to be revealed by American Express right now. But but I thought it was a fun one too. You want to...
We originally had five. The merchant is funding part of the discount. Amex is not funding most of it. And like Amex, Whole Foods, and a couple of the hashtags, the merchants all experienced sellouts. They hit their caps, and they extended them because for the first time they're going to be able to get data, like aggregate data on the consumer. Wow. So far it's been an overwhelming success for Amex and for the brands.
Thank you for sharing that with us. serendipitous to have your case study in the room. Well, I'd like to jump and talk about mobile wallet. So I think I mentioned earlier that by 2015, $1 trillion, that's trillion with a TR, is going to be flowing through mobile wallet, which is a mega shift. Does this represent just a must-do for retailers? Is everybody just going to do it and it becomes, you know, kind of like a nothing? Or is there a way to really harness mobile wallet to work on behalf of, you know, retailers? Oops, sorry, I have to go back to yours, Tom.
Yeah.
Look at what one it is, too. Yeah. Sorry. There it is. So.
We good?
John, all right. Thought you could take that.
Yeah. So how many people here use their mobile wallet today? That's what I thought. In case you couldn't look backward. And no, the Starbucks mobile app doesn't count in that. I was talking about the quote real one. So here's the problem. Mobile wallets, you know, if you're a brand, I mean, what is a mobile wallet trying to do, right? Well, I'm not going to talk about NFC and whether or not it's going to happen or not. It's not for a while. The real question is all they're trying to do is replace credit cards, right? So if you think about the process of using your wallet, and I love the Starbucks mobile app. It is brilliant. I think it's wonderful. It's training us all a wonderful behavior, which is to pay with this device, which ultimately we'll do. But the process, right? I touch the home button, I unlock it, I punch in my code, I open the Starbucks app, I wait for the card to load, then I hold it, then the person goes, oh, you're paying with your mobile phone, and I hold it. And that was really so much faster than pulling out my credit card and swiping it, right? No, it wasn't. So the point is all it's trying to do is replicate an existing process. Now, ultimately, I do think that this is viable. But the key that is missing here, right, is what's the incremental value? Why do I want to do this, right? Why do I want to use this type of payment? What is the value to me as a consumer? And when that perspective is put into place, right, I don't care about, you know, the what do they call it? Transfer fees? I don't know. You know, Tom, what is it?
Interchange fees.
Interchange fees, right? I don't care about the interchange fees as a shopper, right? What I care about is, you know, is this easy? Is it smart? Is there value? You know, am I creating a good experience with the, you know, or receiving a good experience from the retailer or brand. So fundamentally, mobile wallets are an interesting concept, but alone, all they are trying to do is replace a credit card. And until there is incremental value, until there are offers integrated to it, until there is intelligence and loyalty built into it, we are not going to see a tremendous amount of adoption or usage of them.
So actually, I slightly disagree with John on that. Sorry, John. So when you actually talk to Google, you talk to the Surf team at Amex, you talk to a few of those guys that are actually working on those. In all of those visions, the payment piece is one piece for sure, but there's a lot more going into that, and that includes anything from your loyalty cards and to linking your loyalty card in it to anything around, you know, even, you know, your MTA card if you're living in New York and you want to pay for the subway, or your passport or your ID card, and they all have a pretty big vision about what that wallet should be. NFC, I tend to agree, I think we're probably at least a couple of years away, and one of the gigantic friction is going to be changing the POS system at the retailer level. A bunch of players, including Google, are trying to tackle that by actually financing some of that change, but it's clearly going to take some time. There's nice way to go around that, and some solution exists today around, you know, putting some sort of a sticker on your phone that actually enables still payment. And, you know, when you use your Chase debit card, for example, at Duran Reed, you can actually pay it by tapping on it, by tapping on the POS system. So I totally agree on the fact that if mobile wallet were only about payment, then it's dead on arrival. There's no point to it. But I actually feel that they're actually going after a lot more complex stuff. One thing that Google was talking about was the fact of there's some sort of a science to retail. So when you talk to the Walmart guy and you talk about how the L are optimized and where the product are and you know, what is the usual kind of like path of a customer inside a Walmart store, it's actually not something that is left to just randomness, right? It's super optimized. And so there's an interesting way to actually tackle mobile wallet hotspot inside of a Walmart store and optimize the flow of your customers so that they are going to go where you want them to go and take advantage of local promotion, hotspot, stuff like that. So I agree with you. Like, just purely payment doesn't have any sense. I actually think there's going to be a lot of good stuff out of that. But.
And there already is, as we know, in lots of other countries. I mean, I think there is no question about mobile wallet because it's already happening in places like Korea and Japan and Sweden, et cetera. And it's just making its way here based on infrastructure. So I would say there is a holy grail question that digital marketers ask, and that is, how do I know what I did online worked and actually transpired in the store? And that's at the SKU level. And Tom, I skipped over your slide, but I wanted to go back and ask and have you talk
about
that.
Yeah, sure. So everything, and I'll use the Amex example that Florent and our Amex representative in the crowd shared with us. So that's a perfect example of kind of the Model T of where the world's going with the linking it to your card environment, right? So sure, going online, you can find an offer online, you can link it to your credit card, you can go to the store and you can purchase. We've been running those types of programs across any card. We support 100% of cards, not just one flavor, but any card. You can link anything you want of an offer that a brand is supporting. Now that today, as you see too on the Amex version, that's at the merchant level. And that's kind of, like I said, it's the Model T version. Where we're going, though, is right down to the brand level, getting down to the SKU level of a linkable offer. So now a brand can market direct to you and I as the consumer. We see that offer, and it's instead of maybe the $10 off, and I'll throw a good one for Best Buy, $10 off at Best Buy, no matter what you buy, but maybe it's 10% off the Sony TV at Best Buy. That's hard to do because if you're not aware, that SKU level data does not run across the credit rails, right? That's in compare, or that data, that SKU data has to come from the retailers. So what's happening in the retail industry is they've been spending money for a considerable amount of time now, billions of dollars on the couponing, the FSI or the circular piece, that paper that we all pick up. And when the retailers, even still today, want to drive sales, they put out a bunch more circulars, and that drives their sales up. But they have no idea who's buying them. They don't know what's causing it. They don't. All they know is, hey, put more of those circulars out, people will buy. And the brands that are the manufacturers that are sold at retail, they play right along. And what are they getting? Well, they're getting the gated data back from the retailers. So as you now introduce that capability of a brand being able to push their own source of offers, and they can push it into any medium, as we saw earlier, and get it right down to the SKU level, we're changing the way that consumers deal with loyalty, the way that consumers deal with their purchase behavior. And what comes from that now is the brands start to have a direct communication to you and I. And that gets into the ability for them to personalize their offers out to maybe you. So, and I'm skipping through a bunch of this, but here's an interesting example of what could happen. Tom's pretty easy to get to go into, say, Circuit City. Are they still around? I'm using them because they're a brand that I won't hurt anybody's feeling, right? On purpose. So, too late to hurt their feelings, right? So they give me a 10% discount to get into XYZ store, I'll say. But if you take somebody else, it's a lot harder. Let's say they're really a Best Buy customer and this other company wants to get them into their store. Might take 25% to get you in the store. So they can put out a single offer, and since they know your purchase behavior right down to the SKU level, these brands can play your loyalties, and they can push you around into a better situation for either the brand themselves or the retailer. So all of that is done by having that SKU level data, having that attached to your actual payment card that's in your pocket. And who cares if it's Amex card, MasterCard, it's issued by one bank or another bank, doesn't make a difference. This is what the brands can do today. This is functioning now, and the brands can actually drive that direct to the consumer.
And we really are seeing some best-in-class behavior at personalization and localization. I know we have Amex in the room. Another one that everybody talks about is Starbucks. And John, I know you have some specific things you want to say about that.
Yeah, so I love Starbucks. I'm sure many of you do. I waste way too much of my paycheck there, but it's worth it. But the one of the things about Starbucks, if we think about the holy grail of what mobile means, right? We've all heard the idea of, imagine you're walking by a Starbucks, right? And I go there all the time, and a little ad pops up on my phone. It says, hey, John, you're in front of a Starbucks. Get any size tea for a dollar. Sounds awesome, right? Great idea. Fundamental problem, I don't drink tea. I drink coffee. I drink two drinks at Starbucks, hot chocolate and a venti decaf mocha. That's it. So if the offer were in context, hey, John, get your venti decaf mocha right now, it'll change my behavior because I'm there and the offer is personalized. So to Tom's point, this is about understanding shopper behavior, right, and consumer behavior and putting it in context and personalizing that. Because if you combine location and a personalized offer, you will fundamentally change their behavior, whether they're on the street or in the store.
So I'm going to jump on one thing there. Just talk about the – I wanted to agree with John and agree with Florent a moment ago about mobile wallets, but I want to use Starbucks as the example. I want to say that the concept of a mobile wallet, in my opinion, and I'm sure everybody's heard this, is it's a solution looking for a problem, right? But if you can tie a discount to it and it can be personalized to you, then you're going to use it. Well, how many people, and I noticed no hands went up, but how many people buy coffee from Starbucks before we asked a different question? All right, so has anybody downloaded the app from Starbucks in the mobile wallet app? All right, so that's a pretty good mix. I mean, people are getting weaker on your hands as we keep asking you to do this. But so get right up there, man. But the fact is that there's a mobile wallet environment that's tied directly to a brand, and it works. 26, I'm going to be a little dated because I don't know the up-to-date numbers, but 26 million transactions, 4 million users in 6 months. Something worked there. Something actually is happening there. In my own household, I don't even drink coffee, but I hear from my wife and my daughter who drinks coffee and they go to Starbucks that they love the thing, right? It's great. So there's an example of it working, and it's an example of Starbucks who's showing the rest of the world how to use these things called mobile wallets. Just an example.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back for a second on the idea of like gathering data on your customer and making the best use of it. So one thing I was reading about, which kind of like blew my mind, was there's a big supermarket chain in the UK called Tesco, which is kind of like your probably not Whole Foods, but Walmart supermarket chain over there. It's a big leader over there, and so they've actually done something with it's a pretty basic loyalty program. So you earn points as you spend. So they've actually done a good job at that. They've actually got a penetration of about 16 million accounts, which is not bad for the UK. And what's happening is that they have all of your info on the groceries you buy, when you buy it, what frequency, what type of brand do you buy, and so on. And then they look at that data, they actually optimize it, and then they spit out an email which has 9 million different combinations. So that's a huge amount of potential combination. There's about 40,000 average number of products in a supermarket. So imagine the number of potential combination you could have there. Well, they actually have done a good job at putting a very, very personalized email. And a good metric of that is that they have an open rate of about 25% on that email, which for like a classic loyalty email is super high. And the other metrics I wanted to share that resulted for them in about $200 million incremental revenue last year. So when you think about the effect that it can have on your bottom line, I was very impressed by their execution there.
Cool. So we have a big room full of people here. How many of you have questions? Yeah, all right. I'm going to ask one more question, maybe two more questions, but get your questions ready because I think we want to hear from the audience. Anybody from Groupon here today? Okay, let's talk about them. So Is Groupon the 800-pound gorilla of the deal space? You know, is there a position long-term? I'd like to hear from you guys. What are they doing right? What are they doing wrong? Who are the titans in this space going to be? You know, is it a Groupon? Is it a Google, eBay? What do you guys think?
I'm actually not a... So in theory, you should say, you know, Guild City, blah, 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 we're competing with Groupon. Not really, because we're more high-end, they're super mass, you know, it's not that great. But actually, I find that they have... they're actually pretty good. They're actually pretty good at executing. They're pretty good at iterating new product. They're pretty good at innovating as well. And clearly, some deals went down in flame, and clearly... Sometimes their sales guys are a little too aggressive, remove the cap from their merchant, and things go down. But there's a lot of deals that you don't hear about that actually goes pretty smoothly. So the other piece that I actually think they're pretty good at is, at the bottom of it, Groupon is all about local advertising, right? So it's enabling a local merchant to communicate and acquire new members. You can do it a bunch of different ways. So they started by doing it in that Groupon aspect, but they're actually innovating on a bunch of different stuff around it, where now they're pushing, you know, there's something that they've just launched, which is Groupon Goods, which is going to be kind of more of an e-commerce platform. They're also launching, you know, they launch a self-serve platform for merchants. So there's a couple of good stuff they're doing. The key thing that I think they're going to have to be good at is just they haven't been able yet to prove back to those merchants that are using them that the people they bring them are the valuable people. Okay. And so I feel that's probably something that there's going to be the key stuff for them. They bought a company called Zapity, which main goal is to try to prove that, right, by tapping into payment processor. They track you, and then they say, hey, you know, you just bought a Groupon. Looks like 2 months later you went back to that merchant, so I can now tell you, merchant, that the people I'm bringing to you are just non-one-time purchaser. They're actually people that are coming back to you. But I think that overall, I actually think that it's a pretty good company.
Good.
So here's the thing about Groupon. If anybody didn't know that when they did their IPO, it was actually priced lower than the prior round that the VCs paid. So, and the VCs are still underwater on that. So, unbelievable company, done unbelievable growth, shown a lot. Is it successful financially? Well, not yet, right? But as Florent says, there's going to be an incredible. Now they've got a ton of money, and they can do just about anything they want because they have tens of millions of transactions all the time and people and so forth. But one of the things that Florent also mentioned, and in this case study talks about it a little bit, this is the functionality of a brand or a retailer having the ability to utilize the credit rails in a linked offer environment. Now, what Groupon does not do, and several other companies that are in that space, aren't able to track that impact on the consumer and report that back to the brand or report that back to the retailer. This case study is one that was at a home improvement store, $5 off, $30 or more. The advertisements went up on their Facebook page, went out through email to their loyalty teams or to their loyal customers, and several other avenues where the consumer was able to link that offer directly to their credit card. They went into the store, they made a purchase, and what we were able to report back to them afterwards was, and I'll do this quickly, but the transactions per 30 days prior to the campaign were on average, or across the 500 people, so this is a slice of 500 consumers that were in this pilot that they did, was 28 total transactions. Now, during the campaign, it was 180 transactions from those same people. Did that campaign drive users to their store? Absolutely, right? They absolutely drove it there, and those same people did many more transactions, and then the lower one is the average purchase. So you can see in the average basket on the lower right that the average basket went up also. Now, the cool thing is that we were able to track all of this because we have that tie into the credit rails, track all that, and then what's not there. And what we can do also for the brands and the retailers is we can show those exact users how over time that campaign might have changed the behavior of that consumer. So now that consumer has gone through the campaign, they linked the offer, they went in, that drove a bunch of additional impact here. But then afterwards, you can look at those same users and you can see, were they continually loyal? Did that campaign have a lasting effect? Good luck any daily deal site showing that kind of data yet, until that's that ability to link an offer and then track a user's ongoing transaction. So,
okay.
Hey, Sarah, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the 800-pound gorilla is the coupon. 320 billion of them issued a year.
460 right. billion, dude.
Yeah.
$460 billion in 2011 with $4.6 billion that we all collected, we redeemed in 2011. So the coupon still works.
Which is, by the way, the size of the daily deal market in 2012, which is about $5
billion. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the question is if 99% of coupons are wasted, where does that put it? And I think the opportunity for it is the contextual coupon, the one that is delivered in context of you as an individual when you're ready to buy, whether it's through a credit card, a mobile app, deal, whatever it is.
So wide open prairie for digital deals to grow. Okay, I'd like to hear from you guys. I saw a hand shoot up right over here.
Lauren, can I get it?
Yeah.
From the guilt side, I think it started with cash flow, right?
Right.
So sites like Amazon and eBay, you guys, mix of brands, third-party sellers, what do those say to the deal space going forward? Guilt is very niche, a lot of different offerings, but what role do those sites play going forward?
So for people who couldn't hear, so the question was guilt, niche, fashion, and then there's bigger players, at least players, like eBay and Amazon. And what are those guys role playing forward in that same space, correct? Right. So
In fashion
specifically. Okay. So, Amazon launched something called My Habit not so long ago. By the way, American Express also, and that's not my favorite part of American Express, but they also launched something similar called Vente Privée in the U.S. Around same thing, sample sale, online sample sale, and so on. I actually think that it's just one model of selling. So for Amazon, it's one business among a bunch of different businesses. They have a bunch of different lines. They have a big share. They own a big piece of Living Social as well. So my take on fashion specifically is that we tend to we launched a couple of different verticals, but all of them were catering the same idea of high-end customers. And I feel that even though those guys are going after that space, I don't see that as a long-lasting business, because I feel that fashion as it is today on My Habit is not a very great experience in terms of buying it. Same thing on Vente Privée, by the way. And I feel so the biggest issue there for those guys is going to be getting the right merchandise and the right brand onto those platforms. And so that's a little bit my take on it. But let me know if I didn't tackle that right. Yeah, good.
Okay. How about you?
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think it's a factor of a couple of stuff. It's a factor of the demographic you're addressing. It's a factor of the type of merchant you're pushing. It's a factor in how you actually communicate on those merchants. It's a factor of the design. It's a factor of the creatives you're putting behind, and so on. Our approach at Citi is to say that we want to think of us almost as a city guide, right? So we want you to discover new places in your city. So stuff you haven't heard of necessarily, stuff that are fun, cool, vibrant. We tend to spend a lot more money than our competitor on the quality of photo and creative around it. We tend to redesign every 6 months our site because of that. And so I feel that it's, you know, it really depends on how you, you're communicating around that. And also how often do you run those offers, right? So my example on Virgin America was to say, hey, we did last summer a flight offer with them. 6 months later, we should do something different so that we don't have people waiting for the exact same promotion. So I think that's really about you guys, or at least the people who are at the brand level, to say to the people they want to work with, whether it's Guild City or Groupon Living Social, to say, hey, those are the parameters I want to go after. Those are the type of thing I want to push up. And I also want to avoid that kind of like repetitive behavior that is very cannibalizing for my own brand. So you guys should have that approach and should have that vision. We can help you craft that, but you should have a good sense of that before you start the discussion, because if not, you know, you're going to meet a sales guy. He's going to say, oh, no, it's good. And, you know, 3 months after that, if the sale was successful, the first thing he's going to do is want to do the exact same deal, right? So that would be my answer.
Yes.
It's personalization, right? It's knowing your user. It's knowing the consumer. The data that's available today, especially now that the financial institutions are starting to come to the fore, and they're sharing now data and profiles about consumers, and there's going to be a big uproar from the consumer advocates that are going to say, oh, my God, they're going to share all my data. Well, I tell you what, the data that they have is half of what you shared yesterday on Facebook, okay? So the fact is that we all use in our loyalty cards every day. We're giving data to the brands, and the brands are marketing to us. So partnering with the financial institutions who are dying to monetize their value of their data, and they're working with brands that want to personalize that experience or those offers or get somebody more loyal. And you'll see in the U.S., AMIA is a company that's has an incredible loyalty program. It's like the Sky Miles and those types of loyalty, but they're getting very creative, and they're starting to use other purchase history. So looking at the purchase history, not at your particular properties or your particular vertical even, but looking at the purchase history across a universe of purchases for a group of community or group of consumers, and then determining, well, those are the people that we want. Because look, and I could go on and on and on about this, but that data is what is going to be driving that loyalty piece. And there's an opportunity then to personalize the offers and make a consumer. It almost goes back to what we heard over here of, well, I'm waiting for something, you know, what should I get? Well, that data that you use and you put it around the audience is what's going forward now for creating loyalty programs.
Can I just chime in too? Because that was a pretty broad question, and it's not necessarily just about the deal space, I don't think. I'm going to plug a friend's book. Clark Kokich, the chairman of Razorfish, just wrote a book/app that's for the iPad called Do or Die. I think Starbucks is featured in it, Virgin America is featured in it. But if you feel like your brand isn't that cool, it talks about the things that you can do to make your brand cooler. And a lot of people are pulling budget forward into actually addressing the brand side with digital products. So it's just something to consider. Yes?
So I kind of have a point to the question. I guess it's a great queue up for data to talk to about it. But I guess when I hear the blending of my personal banking data across, I know that there's a point to say nobody's worried about this, but I think that a Groupon or if I'm going to Starbucks, I assume that my data is being shared with the place that I've selected. And so what I'm wondering is, I think it's easy. I'm kind of an agency world, so understand it's easy to focus on a brand-centric solution that's about the brand and the brand being able to sell the times they want to sell and the sales. But where does a consumer-centric view come in, and where does this panel sit in terms of where they feel like is the right balance of data privacy and transparency, and where do they think the industry sits in terms of data transparency and privacy?
I'll start off on this one if you want. So I'm a 20-year advertising guy. It's all I've ever done in all different mediums, mobile, online, print, and now my company is doing it across all different mediums, and we're working with every type of medium, radio, broadcast, and everything else that I mentioned already. We go with we're coming to market with a concept that takes your purchase history from your credit and debit cards. Talk about loyalty scare, if you will, loyalty, hysteria is the word I'm looking for. If you get a consumer advocate that gets their hands on this, and it did show up in the New York Times, and it actually started to get some chatter about it. The way that we're approaching it is through a double opt-in. Number one, talking about 101 here, we go with a full capability to anonymize the consumer. The consumer is a number. They're a cookie. They're a device. And we go with pull only. So now the consumer has offers that may be based on their history, their purchase history. It may be based on things that they transact on one or more different cards. That's all that data is then sitting behind the firewalls of the banks. Now, I say all of that just because those are the steps that are being taken. And now I push out to you that all that data is already being used on all of us. I mentioned earlier, and almost everybody in the room put their hand up, that you all have a loyalty card from a retailer, probably multiple retailers. And all of that data is out there. All of that data has your email address and your name on it. What the actual direction that this better profiling of a consumer, taking purchase history and so forth, and informing the consumer, hey, you're opting into this, that this data is going to be utilized as an anonymous user, and your offers that you will now see, you'll consume in standard media. The same commercials that we see on TV, the same banners we see on the internet, the same ads we might see on our mobile devices, all now mean more to us. It's almost a delivery on a promise that, yes, I've been selling since 2000. Oh, you know, the ads are going to be better, you know, because we're going to target you. Well, a little of it was hooey, but it's real now. It really can happen because of the technology. So I think privacy is incredibly better than it's ever been and getting better every day. When those loyalty cards do go away and it actually goes to an anonymous user of a credit card data, it's a better environment for us. And I look for the consumer advocates, and I say what I said earlier. I bet they put more, or you put more on Facebook yesterday about your life that's more relevant to your private life than you did on your credit card, and that's the type of data that's really valuable. So.
Okay, I'm sorry. These were great questions, and you were a great audience. I wish I had time for more. Hey, will we ever pay full price again? Probably not. Thank you to the panelists.
Thanks,
that was great.